Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
After all that hand-wringing and arm-twisting over a payroll tax cut extension, the latest congressional impasse looks to be over. So, will Uncle Sam be taking more out of our paychecks or not? Here's a hint. House Republicans just blinked. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, it's the Marketplace podcast for Thursday, December the 22nd. I'm Bob Moon, in for Kai Ryssdal. Glad to have you with us. House Republicans just did an abrupt about-face on their previously dug-in heels, and it now looks, as certain as things ever do on Capitol Hill these days, that 160 million Americans won't be hit with higher Social Security taxes. Our D.C. Bureau Chief John Dimsdale joins us. John, what happened?
Well, the House Republicans have backed down from their insistence that the payroll tax holiday last an entire year. They're going to accept instead a 2-month extension, just like the Senate approved, but with some conditions, some minor language changes to help small businesses cope with the tax reporting requirements under this short-term payroll tax extension. And that'll give the Republicans something to show for holding out most of the week for a year-long extension. But, you know, when he announced the deal, House Speaker John Boehner was asked whether he had caved in a showdown with the Democrats, and he basically conceded he had to cut his losses.
You know, sometimes it's hard to do the right thing, and sometimes it's politically difficult to do the right thing.
And he said that while he was fighting the good fight, it may not have been politically smart.
Yeah, they were just facing intense pressure, weren't they, John?
Absolutely. I mean, even their own party members, allies, they were under such pressure not to hold up this tax cut. Unlike the debt ceiling stalemate last summer, which involved government borrowing and sort of big macroeconomic financial issues, this impasse had to do with some very personal, individual money issues. How much money will all those American workers get in their paychecks just 2 or 3 weeks from now? When it gets that personal, public pressure can be brutal on politicians.
So what's next? When can they get this wrapped up?
Well, assuming enough House Republicans get behind Speaker Boehner, this can be sealed even in a matter of hours. With some unanimous consent rules, the House can change the language in the Senate bill, send it back for senators to agree to, and then the president can sign it all by this weekend so that he could salvage some of his holiday vacation in Hawaii.
Marketplace's John Dimsdale in Washington, thanks.
You're welcome.
The government provided us with a little more holiday cheer today, news that unemployment claims have dropped to their lowest level since April 2008, before most of us realized a recession was setting in. Add in slowly improving consumer sentiment and economic growth, and economist Joel Naroff is looking forward to the new year.
There's a whole set of reasons to believe that the recovery, which has been picking up some steam, will continue to improve as we go through 2012.
On the other hand, at IHS Global Insight, Chief Economist Nigel Gall tells us not to get our hopes up too much.
Well, I don't think it's signaling a strong recovery. I think we're somewhere in between here.
Gall says, yes, it's good news, but there are plenty of headwinds the economy is still struggling against. There was a time when law school all but guaranteed a ticket to a good life. There's a reason Mom always wanted you to be a doctor or lawyer. But as plenty of recent grads will tell you, today that golden ticket might just buy you a boatload of debt and a temp job. Thus the focus on this challenge, how to deal with this oversupply of lawyers. From the Marketplace Education Desk at WYPR, Amy Scott reports.
How about giving would-be law students a more realistic view of their future? Todd Kelly graduated from the Massachusetts School of Law in 2009.
Of my class of about 50, I think there's a half dozen, let's say, working in the legal field that I know personally, and only a couple that are actually working as attorneys.
When Kelly couldn't find a job, he started his own firm and folded it when he couldn't make enough money. He's now working as a software sales engineer.
I think what I didn't fully appreciate was just how difficult it would be to get that first job.
Julie Margetta Morgan wants to change that. She's a policy analyst at the Center for American Progress, a left-leaning think tank. In a new report, she says the federal government should publish data on what workers can expect starting out in any field. Right now, if you looked on the Bureau of Labor Statistics website, you'd see that the average lawyer makes more than $125,000 a year. But Morgan says most new lawyers can expect to make half that, and they owe, on average, upwards of $90,000 in student loans.
The problem is that there just aren't jobs out there to support that kind of debt for students at this point.
The American Bar Association, which accredits many law schools, recently changed its standards. It'll require members to report more detailed job placement data for their graduates. But law grad Todd Kelly says they'll be up against a little denial.
I believed I would be an exception to the rule.
Don't we all? I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
No holiday red, just green for the major gauges on Wall Street today. Details when we do the numbers. Here's my nomination for the understatement of 2011. It's been a tough year for Europe. The debt crisis, downgrades, and decreased spending might be crimping the holiday cheer in many of the Euro nations. But in Germany, which enjoys the continent's strongest economy, consumers seem to be in a buoyant mood. Christopher Wirth has been checking out the scene in Hamburg.
Germany's traditional Christmas markets are famous throughout Europe, with sparkling lights, hot mulled wine, and, sure, a few drunken carolers. While places such as Britain and Greece suffer austerity, shoppers here are spending as much as ever. People like Hamburg resident Jörg Bach.
Sure, people in Germany have to pay for the crisis with our tax. But if I don't feel the crisis, and I hope that I don't feel the crisis.
This year, consumers are spending more in Germany, and that's benefiting traders like jewelry shop owner Zippy Lev.
It's much more better this year. You know, Germany is a very, very rich country, and the people here have a lot of money.
And Germans are expected to spend more of it this Christmas than their European neighbors. Fredrik Frejus says his stall selling housewares is doing much better than the one he runs back home in France.
Germany is stronger than France. In Germany, you have a lot of factory. It's a country that produces many things.
Unemployment in Germany is currently at a record low of 5.5%, or half the European average. That's another reason Germans are spending freely, says Christian Schulz, a senior economist at Berenberg Bank.
Well, Germans think that they deserve to spend more because they've really tightened belts earlier in the decade.
And the idea that Germans are starting to consume goods almost as eagerly as they export them is welcome news to Germany's trading partners, not least the U.S., which has urged Germany to consume more. Again, Christian Schulz.
It's not going to boost American GDP immediately, but over the long term, Germany will import more goods, and that will benefit America just as it will many other countries.
And American retailers doing business here should do better as well. Germany can be a tough market to win over, and some U.S.-owned stores like Walmart and The Gap even threw in the towel here a few years ago. But Natalie Berg of research company Planet Retail says things are starting to turn around.
What we are seeing now is some retailers are taking a renewed interest in the German market. So we had Abercrombie and Fitch open their first store in Dusseldorf earlier this year. And we're even hearing that The Gap could be interested in re-entering Germany.
Back at the Christmas market, the crowds are full and the traders are busy. But as Europeans have learned, good times don't last forever. Sure, German unemployment is low right now, but the crisis in the rest of Europe could still hit Germany's exports when the cheer of Christmas gives way to the cold, hard light of the new year. In Hamburg, I'm Christopher Wirth for Marketplace.
When Julie Andrews sang these words all those years ago, who knew she was actually delivering those kids from The Sound of Music a lesson in psychology?
Brown paper packages tied up with strings. These are a few of my favorite things.
Now there's some real science that helps explain that sentiment. Seems test subjects who got presents tied up in brown paper were actually happier than they were with flashy packaging. And you might just want to skip the wrapping altogether. That's a conclusion of marketing professor Nathan Novemsky at Yale University's Center for Customer Insights. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Bob.
Take the wraps off your survey for us. How was it conducted and what did you find?
So we were very interested in this question of how gift wrapping influences people's reactions to gifts, how much they like them, and also their willingness to reciprocate to the gift giver. And, you know, I've had this experience some time ago when giving my wife gifts where I would try to go the extra mile, get the fancy bow and the nice wrapping every time I gave her something. And I'd notice a little tinge in her eye when she would open the gift that almost suggested she was a little disappointed sometimes. So that encouraged us to run a few studies to give people gifts and see how they reacted to the same gift depending on how it was wrapped. And one of the interesting findings was that if you wrap a gift, you raise people's expectations and their liking of the same gift goes down. If you wrap a gift that, you know, is just meant to be a little something, it might really behoove you not to wrap it, or if you're going to wrap it, to not wrap it so nicely.
Now, we're not just talking about the kind of wrapping paper. We're talking about not wrapping a gift at all to keep expectations lower, huh?
That's right, because you can imagine that, especially as a gift that's wrapped sits under your Christmas tree for, you know, days or weeks, for example. You start to imagine what's in there, and you get pretty high expectations. And when Christmas finally comes or the time comes to finally open that wrapping, you know, you're imagining something great. Whereas if I just say, here's something for you and hand you something that you can immediately see, there's no chance for those expectations to creep up.
Now, what if the gift is ambiguous, if you don't know whether it's going to be a big hit or not?
Very good question, Bob. So it turns out that there's a big difference between things that we know what they are and things they don't. So if I give you a Harry Potter DVD, you know exactly what that is and, you know, you have some liking for it. If I give you a pair of earrings, you don't really know if they're really nice earrings or if they're okay earrings or if they're, you know, cubic zirconia fake diamond earrings. And so in those cases, when the thing is ambiguous, the wrapping might actually do the thing you want it to do, which is very nice wrapping might signal to people, ah, this is a good gift.
Does this say anything about the bigger picture of advertising? I mean, we always hear it's all in the packaging.
You can take this way beyond gift giving to all kinds of things, right? You know, the packaging on a gift or even a fancy glass of champagne that a nice restaurant gives you for free before you start the meal. Any of those things could have the same kind of ironic effect. If you're setting expectations high and you're not delivering on them, you're going to be worse off than if you hadn't tried to set expectations at all.
So if you're a hotel, for example, you don't want to spruce up the outside of the building or the lobby if you're not also sprucing up the rooms?
Exactly. We tend to have this idea in our heads that we get from our culture and from a lot of places that wrapping universally is a good thing and better wrapping is better than less good wrapping. So I think in general, I would just tell people dial down the amount of effort, the amount of time, the amount of expense you're willing to put into gift wrapping because it's not really making people happier and more willing to reciprocate.
Nathan Novemsky is a professor of marketing at the Yale School of Management. Hope you get lots of great gifts this year.
Thank you, Bob. And unwrapped if I'm lucky.
Coming up, seen these commercials?
Let's put a end to famine.
Why, your money may not be going where you think it is. But first, let's do the numbers. Better than expected jobless claims and consumer confidence drove the markets forward today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 0.5%, or 61 points, to end at 12,169. The NASDAQ climbed 0.8%, or 21 points, to close at 2599. The S&P 500 also climbed 0.8%, or 10 points, to finish at 1254. Investors rewarded bank stocks. J.P. Morgan Chase advanced 3.5%. Bank of America padded up 4.5%. Citigroup and Morgan Stanley each deposited around 6%. Micron Technology zoomed up more than 15% after the maker of the memory chips reported a wider first quarter loss than expected. Here's the explanation. Analysts predict there will be a pickup in demand for PC chips this spring. Prices for 10-year T-notes gained. The yield fell to 1.95%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
on the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at events coming up Friday. The Commerce Department reports on personal income and spending for November. It's the anniversary of the Federal Reserve Act, passed on December 23, 1913, creating the Federal Reserve System. And be sure your Wi-Fi is up and running. With the help of the North American Aerospace Defense Command, you can track Santa this weekend and make sure he doesn't pass up your house. You did bake something, right? I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Rizdal. One way to gauge how well a politician might be able to turn the economy around is to see how they manage their own money. The Wall Street Journal has spent 2 years looking into the investment activities of all 535 members of Congress. And today, the paper is focusing on presidential hopeful Ron Paul, the Texas congressman who has long crusaded for a return to the gold standard. As you might expect, his investment preferences reflect that in a big way. Jason Zweig is the Journal's investing columnist. Thanks for joining us.
Good to be with you, Bob.
Tell us what you found out about Ron Paul's portfolio.
It's one of the most unusual portfolios I've ever seen. It's certainly the most unusual portfolio on Capitol Hill.
So where is he putting his money?
Gold. Almost all of it. You know, most people who have a strong view about the financial future put a little more money in the thing they believe in and a little less in the things they don't believe in. And he's pretty much made an all-in bet on the one thing that he does believe in, which is that gold is sound money and that government bonds are not. And apparently the stock market also is not.
Now, he's really taken aim at the foundations of both the U.S. and global economy. Is there anything wrong with him investing in gold? Isn't he putting his proverbial money where his mouth is?
That's exactly what he's doing. Whether it's prudent is maybe a different question. I mean, obviously, if Ron Paul's view of the world turns out to be true, this kind of portfolio will also turn out to be a profitable one. But if you've got 64% of your money riding on a bet that your worldview is correct, and you do turn out to be wrong, it's not going to be a pretty picture.
Well, let's look at the performance. Has he lost any money in the last 2-3 years?
No, I don't think so. It's hard to get a precise measurement on rate of return with any congressional portfolio because the disclosure requirements don't require detailed reporting on the dollar amount of the positions. So we could only make the roughest estimate, but I have no doubt that this portfolio has outperformed the stock market as a whole over the past few years.
And as you would probably underscore, past performance is no guarantee of future return.
Yeah, that's correct. And one of the concerns here is, you know, diversification is a form of insurance. And when you diversify, you're not just insuring against the risk that other people are wrong, but you also want to insure against the risk that you're wrong. We might have inflation coupled with a collapse in the U.S. dollar, as Ron Paul foresees, but there are a lot of other bad things that could happen to the American economy too, and this kind of portfolio won't protect against those. Plus, good things could happen. And in that case, this kind of portfolio is unlikely to make much money at all.
Jason Zweig is an investing columnist for The Wall Street Journal. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Bob. My pleasure.
Okay, admit it. At some point in your life, chances are you've mailed a letter to the North Pole. If not on behalf of yourself, then maybe someone in your family. The U.S. Post Office says it typically handles more than 1 million letters addressed to Santa Claus every December. This year, our commentator Nate DeMayo decided to write his own letter, not to the North Pole, but maybe a supplier of toys to Mr. Claus.
Dear Abby and Emma, the girls in my daughter's magnetic dress-up doll kit from the toy company Melissa and Doug. I have to admit that my wife and I were a little queasy when you showed up in our house as a present for our daughter's second birthday. We tend to go for toys that aren't gender-specific. But our daughter liked dressing you up. And it helped her find motor skills. It helped her figure out that pants don't go on one's head. And whatever, she's a toddler. Plus, you were made by Melissa and Doug, the eponymous toy company that has become crazy successful by being the progressive, wooden, faux small business alternative to plastic toy leviathans like Fisher-Price and Mattel. A year since your arrival, our daughter still plays with you. But here's the thing. She's 3 now. and I've decided it's time for you two to get jobs. Because now that she knows that pants don't go on her head, all she's really learning is fashion, which super cute top goes best with which skirt. But I figure work clothes are different. A firefighter's clothes are functional. She needs gloves, she needs a helmet. A doctor needs scrubs, maybe one of those old-timey head mirrors. Work clothes would inspire imaginative play and prompt questions beyond, did these jeggings make my wooden butt look big? But guess what, Abby and Emma? Melissa and Doug don't make work clothes for you. They do for these two bigger girl dolls, but their clothes won't fit you. And yes, ballerina is technically a profession, though I am less sure about princess. There is one of the larger dolls who does have cool work clothes. His name is Joey. So Abby and Emma, you can't be astronauts. And you can't help our daughter dream about being a scientist or a police officer either. Sorry, girls. And while I know there is more to parenting than purchasing, if you do talk to Melissa and Doug, if they maintain some sort of magical, Geppetto-y psychic link to you two, can you let them know that there's more to being a girl than just being girly?
Nate DeMayo is the creator of the Memory Palace podcast and co-author of Pawnee, the Greatest Town in America. Care to write your own letter? Head to marketplace.org and click on the contact link. This holiday season, you're no doubt bombarded with ads from charities on TV, online, on Facebook. Perhaps you've heard George Clooney talk about famine in Africa. Noble cause, but here's the thing. A bunch of people find those ads misleading. Marketplace's Scott Tong recently returned from the Horn of Africa. He came back and filed this report.
You may have seen this nifty public service ad from One.org about Somalia's famine.
Let's put a end to famine.
Celebs talk to the camera, but they're all bleeped out, because they all say the F word. George Clooney, Jessica Alba, Kristen Davis, all bleeped. And then comes Bono.
Famine is the real obscenity.
Famine. The real F word. You get it. But here's what has many aid workers actually cussing about. After the ad, One.org wants you to sign a petition to support a federal program that doesn't feed starving Somalis. It's called Feed the Future. More F-words.
Feed the Future does not operate in Somalia. It is not delivering emergency food relief.
Analyst Bronwyn Bruton is with the Atlantic Council think tank.
It's probably unintentionally misleading, but definitely I don't think that that's an accurate statement.
One.org's Tom Hart says what it's trying to do is to stir two ideas into one campaign.
We believe it was clear.
As in leveraging Somalia's disaster to push disaster prevention in countries next to Somalia. That's what One.org really cares about.
What One focuses on is on long-term systemic and policy change. We also focus on trying to have the U.S. government provide that emergency assistance.
If it's sleight of hand, consider it noble. Development pros agree that long-term investment is the ounce of prevention that East Africa needs. Take this irrigation program in Ethiopia. Programs like Feed the Future pay for water pumps to spread out river water and help farmers produce more. Adam Coons is with the relief group IRD.
Instead of only addressing the emergency, we address the causes of the emergency. You increase their capacity and make them less vulnerable.
The fact is, these programs are hard to raise money for.
We still have donors and situations where people say, no, we can't fund that. It's not emergency-oriented enough. It's too developmental for us right now. We're in the middle of an emergency.
An emergency the feds are piggybacking off, too, with this ad from the Agency for International Development.
Over 13 million people are affected by famine, war, and drought in the Horn of Africa.
Uma Thurman steers you to this message promoting, yes, Feed the Future, which the site says provides emergency food aid. Joel Charney at the Aid Coalition Interaction advised the campaign.
The idea that Feed the Future is a humanitarian response, I would say that's a misrepresentation.
We're always sorry if people are confused.
Nancy Lindborg is assistant administrator at USAID. Misrepresentation?
Feed the Future is an articulation of our commitment to provide both emergency food aid and, most importantly, connect it to those longer-term solutions.
What's missing from all these ads and websites is a separate U.S. government program that actually saves lives in Somalia. And supporters of that program are privately fuming. Joel Charney at Interaction chalks it all up to bureaucratic infighting. Everyone wants attention and funding.
USAID does feel under pressure to prove its relevance, to prove its effectiveness, and so on.
The key for the viewer is watch these ads carefully. Now, if you're a sports fan, there's another one on the way, starring NFL players. Clever idea. So for Africa's sake, pay attention. But pay attention. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
A final note, a bit of not-so-cheery news for some holiday shoppers who ordered online from Best Buy. The country's biggest electronics chain is just now advising some of its customers that it won't be able to deliver their orders in time for Christmas. It blames overwhelming demand for some products. Best Buy won't specify how many orders are affected, but it does say some were placed as early as November. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Ben Adair, John Buckley, Nancy Fargali, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Jonathan Karp, Betsy Streisand, Lisa Tucker, Celeste Wesson, and Loretta Williams are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. I'm Bob Moon. We'll meet you back here tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.